Thanks for the introduction, and thanks for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here and to give a talk here. So I'm going to talk about non-equilibrium physics. Specifically, as you just said, I'm talking about how we can understand non-equilibrium many-body states. So this is work done in collaboration with Alexei Gorshkov. So usually we're interested in properties of a physical system, but the system is almost never completely isolated from the environment. There's always some coupling to the environment. And if the environment is at some temperature T, then the state of the system is described by the thermal state. But this is only if the coupling of the system to bath is weak. And this is actually quite remarkable if you think about it, because the only property of the bath that shows here is just the temperature. And again, this is only if the coupling to the bath is weak. So in many-body physics, we're asking the kind of question that what are the phases of matter and what are the phase transitions between them? In particular, whether the phase transitions are quantum or thermal, and what are the sort of correlations and dynamics of the system? So many-body physics in condensed matter systems has a number of characteristics. Typically, the system is in equilibrium, and this is because condensed matter systems have a very short relaxation times. And also, dissipation is unwanted, but it's unavoidable, and because the system is almost always coupled to some bath. In atomic, molecular, and optical physics, one goal is to simulate condensed matter systems, and this is possible because of the high degree of control and engineering in the systems, but we can actually do more. The system can be away from equilibrium. In fact, the system can be driven constantly and continuously far from equilibrium. And also, dissipation can also be unwanted, but it can be controlled. Not only the amount of dissipation, but even the type of dissipation can be controlled in this kind of systems. So I'm going to talk about many-body systems which have a combination of derive and dissipation. And I'm going to tell you why these systems are interesting, why they're relevant, and why we should think about them just in a fundamentally different way. So let's start with a simple example. This is a two-level system. The energy difference of the excited state and the grounded state is given by some omega zero. And because of the coupling to the environment, there's also the decay rate gamma to the environment. Now, omega zero is much larger than gamma, often larger by orders and orders of magnitude. So it's the dominant frequency in the system. Now we can imagine that we put a whole collection of two-body systems, and we can allow them to interact with each other with some characteristic energy J. Still, omega zero being much larger than J and gamma and all other energy scales, the many-body physics in this system, at least equilibrium many-body physics, is kind of boring. It's described by a phase that almost all two-level systems are just sitting at their grounded state. But we can derive the system. We can derive the system with something which is almost resonant with omega zero. And then the relevant energy scale is no longer omega zero, but it's actually delta, which is the detuning of the carrier frequency, the laser frequency, from omega zero. So in a regime that delta is comparable to the interaction energy scale, comparable to the decay rate, we might get some interesting and possibly exotic many-body states, and which is schematically shown by something like this here. So the interplay of derive, many-body interaction, and dissipation can, in principle, give us something completely different. And I should emphasize that this system is inherently out of equilibrium. So we cannot tackle the system with the same tools that we use in equilibrium. Before telling you how we should really think about the system, let me give you a few examples of experiments which already exist. So we have Rydberg systems. In this system, we have the usual Rydberg-Rydberg interaction. The excited Rydberg state decays to the grounded state, and also the system is driven. And there are various experiments in many places. Another example is exciton-polariton condensates. So this is a condensate of polaritons, but polaritons are lossy. So to maintain a steady state, we have to constantly pump the system. And then the question is whether we can actually form a condensate. And the answer is remarkably yes, at least in certain cases. So this is an interesting example that we have an interplay of dissipation and derive. There are also other examples. We have microcavities, which are based on circuit QED, or trapped ions. And in all the systems, we have interaction, dissipation, and drive. OK, so the dynamics of, so I'm also looking at the Markovian systems. The dynamics is described by an equation like this. So rho is a density matrix. There is a coherent dynamics, which is described by some Hamiltonian. And there is also dissipation to the environment, which I just described by the symbol. One thing I would like to emphasize is that this Hamiltonian is a Hamiltonian in the rotating frame, because we derive the system. So in fact, it's natural to go to the rotating frame. And possibly, we would also make a rotating vapor approximation to get rid of fast modes of the system. So this is not the fundamental Hamiltonian of the system, but this is actually the Hamiltonian that we engineer. And then the kind of question that we would like to ask is, what is the many-body steady state of the system, where dt rho is zero? So this is, again, very different from question in equilibrium, that what is the grounded state or what is the thermal state? In fact, in this case, properties of Bethe are quite important, because there is a competition between these two terms. And the state of the system is not a thermal state. In fact, we can imagine that we couple the system to a few different Bethe at different temperatures. So even if there's going to be something like this, it's not even clear what's the temperature that should be describing this. So, yes?
I have a simple question. Suppose there's no driving.
Yeah.
Then H is just a simple Hamiltonian for a static system.
Yeah.
So how do we know that in that case, the thermal state is the solution to the static state solution?
Right. That's actually a very good question. Thanks for asking this question and stopping me on this point. So if we don't derive the system, then the Hamiltonian is somehow, let's actually think about the zero temperature first. So at zero temperature, the grounded state of the Hamiltonian is happy with this dissipation. So dissipation in the environment, if you don't derive the system, would take you to the grounded state. So there is no competition between these two if you go to the grounded state or also if you go to the thermal state. So this is guaranteed by detailed balance, that the dissipation, if the system is in equilibrium, would drive you to the grounded state at zero temperature or a thermal state. Only if you derive the system, then you have this other Hamiltonian, which, as I emphasize, this is an engineered Hamiltonian. So dissipation doesn't have to make Hamiltonian happy. So then there is a competition between the two. And in principle, you would get something non-trivial.
So let's say,
it would actually, so this LD is not just determined by properties of Bethe, it's also determined by the properties of the system. So it already knows about the many body interaction in the system.
Right, so in a sense, if you fix the dissipative dynamics or the term by requiring detailed balance.
Yeah. Yeah, in
how
equilibrium.
How do you fix the coefficients in the underlying
equation? Yeah, I guess you can think about it that way. Yeah. But I hope I made one thing clear, that in equilibrium, we don't have the freedom of choosing Hamiltonian and the environment. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, thank you. That was a great question. By the way, please keep asking me questions.
But you will tell us what LD is.
Yeah. If you want, I can be more precise, but sure. I mean, I will tell you what some terms are in LDR. Yeah, this is the master equation, but I will introduce some other objects that appear in this dissipation. Other questions? Right. You can take the pure set to a mixed state. Sometimes it could be that the you have a darkest state in the system, darkest state which is immune to the dissipation. Once you get to the darkest state, there is no dissipation taking you out of that sector or out of that state. But most typically, you would get to a mixed state. OK, so there is no thermal state. And the question that we're asking is, what are the non-equilibrium phases and phase transition, and basically all the questions that we asked before? And what are also the universality classes that describe them? Would there be the same as equilibrium, or possibly something completely different? And even the system is completely out of equilibrium, We can imagine that there might be some emergent equilibrium. The system might effectively behave as an equilibrium many-body system. And in that case, we would like to know what is the emergent thermodynamics, or what are the equivalents of free energy, temperature, and so on in the system. Okay, with that, let me get to the outline of my talk. I will start with the concrete driven dissipative model. I will do a mean field analysis on this driven dissipative model, but that's the simplest thing to do. But then we would like to go beyond mean field, in particular in regard to questions about the type of phase transition in the system. So for that, I will introduce the Kalish approach, and then I will show that in a wide range of models, we actually get an emergent thermal behavior, even though the system was out of equilibrium to start with. And then I will talk about phases and phase transitions in these models. And towards the end of my talk, I will also discuss the possibilities of getting more exotic phases in this driven dissipative context. Okay, let me actually start from equilibrium. Transverse field Ising model. This is a model that we know and love, and this is a paradigm of condensed matter physics. So there is the Ising interaction, sigma x, sigma x, and the transverse magnetic field characterized by delta. So this Hamiltonian, and by the way, this is not only a special, my discussion is not only special to one dimension, but arbitrary dimensions. So there's a Z2 symmetry in this Hamiltonian, sigma x can go to minus sigma x. And then Landau's paradigm tells us that to identify phases, we have to characterize the symmetry. So an ordered phase, for example, in this model is given by left, 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 or right, 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 depending whether sigma x takes a positive or negative value. Now, a schematic phase diagram of this model is given by this. So at large values of temperature and delta, we get the disordered phase, where the expectation value of sigma x is zero. But for small values of temperature and delta, we get an ordered phase, where sigma x assumes a finite value. And at any finite temperature, the phase transition between the ordered phase and the disordered phase is described by a thermal phase transition. While exactly at zero temperature, the two phases are separated by quantum phase transition. Okay, now I would like to introduce a dissipative analog of the Ising model, which is actually very similar to the Ising model itself. The Hamiltonian is basically just the same, the Ising term and the magnetic field. So this represents quantum fluctuations. But on top of that, I also add dissipation that takes an up spin to a down spin. So this is described by a Limbelot operator, L. And what it means is basically that sometimes the density matrix of the system is being projected on L rho L dagger. And what is nice about this dissipation is that it still preserves the Z2 symmetry. So we can take sigma x to minus sigma x and sigma y to minus sigma y, and the dynamics will be unchanged. And this is because L and L dagger only show up in pairs. So here we can see that already there is a competition between the Hamiltonian and dissipation. The state that makes dissipation completely happy is all the spins down, while the Ising term in the Hamiltonian wants to rotate them back up. And again, I would emphasize that this is not the Hamiltonian, the microscopic Hamiltonian, but this is that we engineered. So that's why we get this competition between these two different dynamics. Yes.
What does it mean sometimes?
So this is another. So this is I told you about the master equation. So master equation is basically differential equation. So in this differential equation, we have d rho dt. Maybe I should write it down. So we have a term which is the coherent dynamics, and this other term is described by something like this. So we have L rho L dagger. So in this sense, this is just a differential equation. But there is another interpretation of this in terms of quantum jumps. So the system evolves under some Hamiltonian, but once in a while, we have a jump. So spin, like an up state jumps to a down state.
At random
times. At random times. But that's just an interpretation of this equation.
They're
just completely equivalent, yeah. So at the level of the master equation, we just have this, we just have deterministic equation. Okay, and one term here, I'm not sure if this even works. Okay, one term here describes the quantum jumps, the other terms describe something else. But the most dramatic effect of this is really this jump term. Okay, so now we have this dynamics, and there's a competition between Hamiltonian part of it and the dissipation part of it, and we would like to know what is the many-body state of this. Okay, so the first and easiest thing that we can do is mean field. So we approximate the density matrix by a product of individual density matrices at different sites. This is actually called Gottsfeller mean field. And we can even make this simpler. We can assume that individual density matrices are uniform. This is independent of I. And that would give us a phase diagram which looks like this. So again, for small values of gamma, which is the dissipation rate, and delta, we get a ferromagnetic order, while for large values of them, we get a paramagnetic phase, which has zero expectation value for sigma x. And the phase transition at the level of mean field, the phase transition is just a second order continuous phase transition.
What does it mean to apply mean field in relation to this
matrix? Yeah. So, as I said, we take rho to be just the tensor product of individual density matrices at individual sites. And then we solve for this kind of equations. For example, let's say we're interested in a spin at site I. We would like to compute this, but because of this assumption, we can actually reduce this to something which only involves the expectation value of, so let's say this is a spin in the x direction. So I can compute this, and I get an equation which only depends on the expectation value of sigma x at point I and at the neighboring points of this. So I would get, generically, I would get something like this, sigma I x or y, something like this, and possibly a coupling of I and j terms.
Is this the assumption that rho remains a product of rhos, of local rhos over time?
So I'm actually looking for the steady state.
Yeah.
So for me, this is independent of the I.
Okay, so you assume that the steady state has this.
Right. I mean, I'm really setting this to zero. But I can, in fact, we can also put some time dependence here to see whether this phase is stable or not. So this is really mean field and then linear stability on top of that.
But the state of this form will not satisfy that it's a stable state. So are you okay with acting with the differential operator and not annihilating all? The definition of steady state would be that
zero
dt is equal to zero.
Right.
But that's not going to happen with this kind of.
You mean with this ansatz?
Yes.
I mean, it can happen. I mean, we can solve this equation and we can set this to zero, and we'll find a solution here. So we can find a steady state solution already at the level of mean field.
That's what you define as mean field.
Right. Yeah, not necessarily. Actually, one of the points that I'm making here is that it was almost always in all the literature on this derivative and dissipative models, people have been doing mean field. So one of the points that I would like to make here is really that how we can go beyond mean field. So yeah, this is just a starting point. And I would tell you that this phase diagram described by mean field is not totally correct. So we have to go beyond this somehow. Yeah. Yes.
In the case when j is zero, can you solve the
j?
Can you solve the
exact? Right, right, yeah.
So there is just.
I mean, in that case, it would be it would behave in some specific way, but I don't think we can, you know, get much intuition from that. Are you asking what's the solution in that case if j is zero?
Yeah.
Actually, I haven't really, I haven't really thought about this. I think that's a very special point. So one thing that I would like to include here is fluctuations, long wavelength fluctuations. So if we decouple the systems, then those fluctuations are not important at all. So the physics of a single spin under derived in dissipation would be very different from this many body setup. Maybe, but I'm not sure. But yeah, that's definitely a special point that we can understand everything about. But yeah. Yes. Yes. Oh, I mean that in this sense. So if I take sigma x and sigma y to their negative values, this equation would be unchanged. If H is obviously Z2 symmetric, and also L is, of course, linear in sigma x and sigma y, but because everything shows by shows bilinearly in L and in Lager, then the dynamics is symmetric under the Z2. Yes. So I'm talking actually about Z2 in the X spaces, right? Yeah. Exactly. Sigma Z does not commute with Li. That's right. I mean, you could also say that sigma Z does not commute with this term. That's true. Yeah. Yeah, I'm saying that that equation is unchanged under that. Okay, so this is the mean field solution, but then this is mean field, so we have to do something better. So at the level of mean field, I mentioned this is a continuous phase transition. It would be ideal if we can do this more systematically and find out whether that's still the case. Also, the nature of phase transition. So in comparison with equilibrium, I told you that at any finite temperature, we have a thermal phase transition, while at zero temperature, we have a quantum phase transition. So we would like to also understand the nature of phase transition here. Would it be described as something thermal, or possibly, I mean, for small values of temperature, the coherence time in the system is very long, which is an indication for this quantum phase transition. So could it be that also for small values of gamma around this point, that we have long coherence time in the system, we would get some quantum phase transition? I mean, so those are actually the questions that I'm posing, and hopefully I will answer them. So we would like to go beyond mean field to address these kind of questions. Okay, now the equilibrium toolbox is not immediately available. Again, we don't have the notions of temperature and free energy and so on. Numerical methods, there are some methods like TDMRG, which works in one dimension, or dynamical mean field theory, which works in infinite dimensions, but of course there's a huge gap between one and infinite. And there are also other methods, variational methods, but they also come with all kinds of limitation. Instead, I would like to focus on the Kalish formalism and how we can learn something useful from that. So I think Kalish formalism has a reputation for being complicated. But in fact, conceptually, I think it's very simple. Let's just start with the unitary evolution in the system. So the state of the system, the mixed state at time t, is described by this. So very schematically, this means that we have to go forward in time for some time t and then come back. Now, if we would like to find some observable at time t, we can just insert it there, and formally we can extend the contour all the way to infinity. So we evolve to time t, we hit the observable, we go to time plus infinity, and we come back. So Kalish formalism actually provides a path integral representation of that. So this is very much like every other path integral that you have ever encountered, except that now we have two different contours, the forward and the backward contour. So we have to introduce fields on both branches of this contour. And let me also tell you what I mean by psi. So for this two-level system, sigma plus is the one that excites the system, and sigma 1 is the one which de-excites it. So in terms of the field, I just mapped this to psi plus and minus. By the way, this plus and minus not to be confused with the lowering and the raising operators. This means that we introduce these fields at the forward or the backward branches of the contour. And sigma plus is the Hermitian conjugate, conjugate of this. So this would be psi conjugate of, as a function of t, but also as a function of the contour. Okay. And then the phase or the action here in this Kellrich path integral is just given by a phase picked up on the forward branch, subtracted by a phase picked up on the backward branch. But dissipation does something qualitatively different. It directly couples the forward and backward branch at any point in time. So we get a coupling of psi plus and psi minus. And then we have to integrate it all over time. And this is proportional to gamma, the dissipation rate, but there's also a factor of I, which makes sense. So this is the dissipative effect that goes to the Kellrich action. So then you would ask me why we should care about this path integral. In principle, this has all the information that we care about. We can find the correlation functions, expectation value of order parameters, and so on. Yes? It's completely equivalent. Yes. Yes. So I think this part is, so this Hamiltonian part, usually in the Kellrich action, people just deal with this. They're interested in some question about dynamics. But in principle, we can also map this. And this is actually the term. And the way to see this is that, so if I write this, this is h rho minus rho h. So here, Hamiltonian appears on the left-hand side of the density matrix. So we get the forward branch. Here it appears on the right-hand side. We get the backward branch. But in a term like this, the density matrix is sandwiched by L and L Lager. So that's why it gives rise to this coupling between plus and minus contours at each point. OK, so there is actually a more convenient basis to go to. This is given by the Kellrich basis. So psi classical is given by sort of the average of the field on the forward and backward branch, while the quantum field is given by the difference. So this terminology makes some sense. If the quantum field is zero at all times, it means that psi plus and psi minus are just identical at all points. So at least for the unitary evolution, the phase that's picked up on the forward branch is just exactly the same as the backward branch, and we just get zero phase. So in some sense, psi quantum describes quantum fluctuations in the system. But also, we're interested in ordered phases. So in an ordered phase, we would expect that psi plus and psi minus generically take a constant expectation value. So that means that for the classical component, we get a constant expectation value, but the quantum field, the expectation value of the quantum field becomes zero. So this is just a convenient basis which makes physical sense. Okay, so now in this problem, we have quite a few components of the fields. We have classical and quantum fields, but this is also complex valued, so we get real and imaginary parts of them. So it would be nice to be able to simplify this. First of all, let me remind you that the order parameter is given by sigma x. And in terms of this psi field, it goes to it maps to the real part of psi. So the ordered phase is defined by some finite expectation value of the real part of psi. So we definitely want to keep track of this component. It actually turns out that we can integrate out the imaginary part of classical and quantum components because they're gapped. And we can see this at the level of the Kellrich action. So the correlation functions for these components always comes with a finite correlation length. So we can integrate it out and find an effective Keldysh action for the real parts of psi classical and psi quantum. Okay, so starting with Keldysh action.
Is the gap everywhere in the phase diagram?
The gap is everywhere in the phase diagram, right. But once we approach the phase boundary between ferromagnetic phase and paramagnetic phase, the correlation length that describes these two components diverge. So, okay, so starting from the Keldysh action, which is a function of four different fields, we can find an effective Keldysh action only in terms of the real components. Okay, so let me just tell you what Keldysh action generically looks like. So in the continuum, and this is a safe limit to take if I'm near the phase boundaries, I have an action which looks like this. So there is a term which is bilinear in the quantum and classical field. There are time and spatial derivatives, but there's also a constant there which controls the critical point. In particular, if I'm exactly on the phase boundary, that constant is zero. There's a term which is quadratic in the quantum field, and that describes the dissipative noise in the system. So there's actually a factor of gamma which I didn't put here. It might be also more complicated than that, but this really comes from a dissipation. And it would become more clear why I call this dissipative noise just in a minute. And there are all sorts of nonlinear terms in the quantum and classical components. Well, we can actually simplify this quite a bit. And the argument for this is quite simple. We just use an argument based on the renormalization group, basically just the power counting of various fields and see which terms are important and which are not. And this is because, again, we're only interested in the long wavelength behavior of the system. So if I scale space coordinate by a factor of b, then I have to scale time by a factor of b squared, as you can see by comparing the time and spatial derivatives. But by demanding that the quadratic part of the system should be a scaling invariant, I can actually read off the scaling dimension of the classical and quantum components. And you can see that the scaling dimensions of the two components is different. In fact, the scaling dimension of the quantum field is quite a bit larger than the scaling dimension of the classical field. And what it means is that I should truncate the quantum field already at the quadratic order, but I should keep track of higher order terms in the classical field. So these nonlinear terms that I talked about, I can have higher orders in the classical field, but not really higher orders in the quantum field. Is this clear, or?
Something that happened, I thought the classical and quantum fields came from linear combinations of the 10 fields. So why can we see that they have different scaling dimensions?
Yeah, so you're right. So we actually started from a plus and minus. But it actually turns out this representation in terms of quantum and classical components is just a better basis to look at, because you can see immediately that there is a term which is proportional to the quantum field squared, and this is proportional to the dissipation rate in the problem, gamma, which never goes to zero. So the quantum field can never be critical. There is a finite coefficient sitting there. So we cannot really tune the quantum field near criticality. So in that sense, the scaling dimension of the quantum field would be just completely different. It's just a different basis to, you know, look at this. In this basis, it becomes more clear what's going on. Yes?
So another thing I'm a bit confused at the moment is that if you turn off dissipation, just the usual phase transition between paramagnetic phase and paramagnetic phase, one plus one.
Mm-hmm.
So there we do have the emergent Lorentzian symmetry at a critical point. So I would assume that it's an unscaled in the same way. But here, currently, it's not.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we reconcile those two features?
Right, right. So this is also a very good question. So first of all, I'm ignoring a bunch of things here. Even the coefficient of this linear term, as you might anticipate from this fluctuation dissipation theorem, the coefficient of this linear time derivative also goes linearly, or possibly could be more complicated, but there would be some dependence on the dissipation rate. If dissipation is zero, then I have to keep the other term, which is actually quadratic in the time derivative. So that would be more like I haven't talked about Landau-Ginzburg yet, but that would put the time and spatial derivatives on equal footing. But if there is some finite dissipation, no matter how small the dissipation is, there would be already a linear term, and we can forget about that term. But also another point which I will come back to later is that if you set dissipation exactly to zero, then the problem is not really well-defined. Or I shouldn't say it's not well-defined, but that would be a singular point. Because exactly when dissipation is zero, you would have infinitely many steady states. So if this is only the only type of dynamics that you have, any eigenstate of the system would also be a steady state. But in fact, adding just a little bit of dissipation makes the steady state unique. Not exactly unique, it would depend on the problem and whether you have any symmetries or not, but at least the huge dimension of the Hilbert space would reduce to one or a few. Sorry, there would be some.
So you have a path integration of the action along this contour. How does that quantity relate to rho?
It would be related in the sense that I can compute all correlation functions either from rho. So I can compute rho O, or I can compute this from the path integral, E to I. I see. Okay, so for the initial state, for this kind of dynamics, we have the Markovian evolution, so all the information about the initial state is actually lost here. So if I imagine that I started at time minus infinity, when I look at the system at some finite time. Is this an assumption? Okay, the assumption is I'm interested in the steady state of the system, right?
In the second one, what is the boundary?
Okay, so there are two infinities, plus infinities and minus infinities. So at plus infinity, the two are just connected. So that's already taken care of in the Kalish. Here, there is rho zero, and in principle, we have to put something here. So this is very much like the usual path integral, that when we do the path integral, we also have. So we start from some point, and we end up in some point. And then so we have the, let's say, x of t, this being x, this being t, time. And then si x. And in principle, we also have to include psi initial conjugate at time 0 and psi final time t. So in principle, there is something that should go here. And for the problems that initial state is important, we have to put something like Wigner function. It actually depends, but sometimes it happens that we can put Wigner function of some sort here. For my purposes, I don't have to worry about this. Again, because the system is Markovian. And also because of the fact that I'm looking at the steady state. So I'm already looking at the point which doesn't care about the initial state. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Is that something you show, or
is that something that I show?
Because if this is a real-time dynamics.
Yeah, definitely. If this is real-time dynamics and if this is a unitary evolution, I have to keep track of this. Yeah, for sure. For this kind of systems. No, I don't think I actually show it rigorously.
Do you have any epsilon prescription
there? That's also, yeah. So all these questions, I think, are related. So again, if we don't have this term, we have to keep track of I epsilon. So we have to keep track of I epsilon to make sense of this. But once we have dissipation, it actually already makes sense of it. Because instead of I epsilon in some generic Green's function, now we have something like I gamma. Yeah, so this is probably another way to see that when we have dissipation, we don't have to worry about certain things that we would worry about otherwise.
You're saying all the memory of the initial state is lost.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think there should be a very good argument for this. My argument was, I guess, a physical argument, but yeah.
Is that even true at the critical point when the correlation time goes to infinity?
Yeah. So even in that limit, there are different. So there is the gap sector. So in the gap sector, still we have dissipation of the order of gamma. But for the kind of dissipation that we would get for these critical components, we have something which goes, so yeah, let me call it just mu. So that one goes to zero. So there is still some dissipation in the system for certain components. But only for a particular critical component of the order prime of the field the relaxation time diverges. Yes?
You have been talking about that this is a driven dissipative system. You are talking about this gamma is about dissipation, but where is the parameter describing the driven?
Yeah.
It should be in rho, right?
Yeah, so this is again something I think which I explained, but thanks for that question, because it just gives me the chance to. This is actually a subtle point. So I have this, I just erased this, but I have two different terms. I have the Hamiltonian and I have dissipation. So what I emphasize that this Hamiltonian is not really, if you want, the bare Hamiltonian of the system. It's a Hamiltonian after you go to the rotating frame. So you have some drive in the system. In principle, you start with a simple Hamiltonian. I mean, the initial Hamiltonian can be just the sum of sigma z terms, and possibly some very weak interaction between different two-level systems. But you have, and okay, this is described by some omega zero, the same omega zero that I talked about one of my previous slides. It is a huge frequency. And we have some many-body interaction, which is described by some characteristic energy scale, which is much smaller than this. So again, this is a boring problem. But then I have to derive the system, so I put some term in the Hamiltonian, which has some time dependence. Let me call it something different. Omega prime, maybe, times t. And there is possibly some term or some component of the spin that I couple these two. And then this is time dependent. So this is, if you want, this is Hamiltonian plus drive. And then I have to go to the rotating frame to get rid of this fast oscillations, and then I have dissipation, of course, independently. Yeah.
So that means actually you use the initial condition into the time dependent.
No, this is not initial condition. This is derived. So this is as a function of time.
Yeah.
I constantly derive this.
And then also eventually the steady state is not time dependent. The Hamiltonian is time.
The Hamiltonian originally is time dependent, right. But this Hamiltonian that I talked about, there is no time dependence there because I already went to this frame which makes sense for my purposes. Now, so I also throw out these other terms which are having fast oscillations.
So your steady state is a steady state in the rotating.
Yeah, yes. Okay, good. Okay, so hopefully I convinced you that we can simplify this quite a bit. So now we have this path integral over classical and quantum components. And this is a Kellish action. In principle, we can have nonlinear terms in the classical field, but the highest order in the quantum field would be just quadratic. Okay, so let's see what this means. Let's first drop this quadratic term in the quantum field. If it drop this term, then the integral over the quantum field, just like this one, gives us a delta function of this whole equation here. But what it means is that it just imposes the equation of motion. Okay, so without including that term, we just get the usual equation of motion. But if we include the quantum field, we can actually see that this becomes a stochastic equation, a classical stochastic equation, or the Langevin equation. So now the noise, this is something whose expectation value is zero, but it has correlations, actually delta function correlations, and that's determined by the quantum field squared. Okay, at this point, we can actually map this to a thermal problem. So this is, if you want, this is something like Brownian motion. But Brownian motion is, yes, single degree of freedom, which is moving in some background potential, which is described by something like this, and is also moving around in some thermal background. And the thermal background has some noise, which is described here. And if you ask what is the steady state of a Brownian particle, that would be described by the background potential divided by the temperature. So this comes from here, and effective temperature comes from this point. Now this is the exact same problem, with the only exception that we have a whole continuum of degrees of freedom. And the many-body effective Hamiltonian, or the field theoretic Hamiltonian of the system, is coming from these terms, and effective temperature comes from the noise. That's true. Right, yeah. So, in fact, this problem shows the thermal behavior. So, in fact, at the end of the day, you go to D dimension. This is another indication that this system behaves thermally. Whereas if you have quantum fluctuation, in principle, you have to go to one higher dimension. And dissipation is responsible for this. So again, if I don't have dissipation, that linear time derivative should be replaced by something which is like dt squared. And for that, if the problem behaves genuinely quantum mechanically, the classical and quantum components behave just exactly in the same way. But the fact that you have dissipation just makes them qualitatively different. So the quantum field here just plays the role of fluctuations in terms of the noise, while the classical field is just a classical field. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, actually my question is very simple. When we do this calculation, do you still assume you can apply with the rotation or not? So do you
No, I mean this is exact. The step that you take from here to here is actually exact. So if you care about the steady state of the system, so in order to show this, you have to look at the Fokker Planck equation. So this is a time-dependent equation for the classical field, but you can also write a time-dependent equation for the probability distribution. But then you're asking a question about the steady state, so you want the probability distribution to be a static. And there you can show exactly that once you have this, this is just an exact statement. If you want, we can discuss this later.
So to go from this Keldysh action to this classical, like you have high order terms and phi classical.
It's okay. I mean,
phi quantum.
Yeah. Right. Right.
So you think that the kind of universality class of the transition here is the same as this kind of universality class for classical dynamics at the classical.
That's exactly my next slide. Yeah. So let's actually go back. This was maybe, I hope it wasn't too technical, but basically we can use all these tools to then come back to our driven dissipative Ising model with this Hamiltonian and this dissipation, and we can show that this is, so let me first actually talk about this phase boundary, which is marked by red. So this model maps to a classical Ising model. Now S just assumes discrete values plus and minus one at some effective temperature, which is given by a combination of quantum fluctuations and quantum jumps. Okay, so there are a few interesting points about this. First of all, let me stress that by this I mean that only the long wavelengths behavior of the two models are the same. So near the phase boundary here, these two models have exactly the same long wavelengths behavior. This is just the Ising transition. This is Landau-Ginzburg, the famous Landau-Ginzburg, 5^4. Okay, another interesting point about this is that, again, this effective temperature does not only depend on gamma, but actually depends on some combination of quantum fluctuations and gamma. And in particular, when gamma goes to zero, effective temperature, approaches a constant value. So that means that perhaps in contrast with the naive expectation that perhaps similar to the equilibrium case that we would get a quantum phase transition here, in this case, we get even a thermal phase transition, even in the limit that gamma goes to zero. There is an order of limits issue, but that was exactly the question that you asked, that what happens if gamma is exactly zero. So this point, so the point that gamma goes to zero is very different from the point that gamma is actually zero. Another way to think about this is that, sure, so if gamma goes to zero, it would take a very long time for the system to approach its a steady state. It would take a time of the order of 1/gamma. But once you wait for this time, then the system goes to a steady state, which is described by this thermal phase transition.
So this mapping,
that was actually exact. So you're right, actually, if you mean this point. So this is I throw out higher powers of the quantum field, but this really comes from this power counting. But here, everything I did in this slide is exact. So once you are happy with throwing out higher powers of the quantum field, you can start from here and you get here. Yes, in some sense. So you can make a Hubbard Sturtevant transformation to write this quantum field in terms of a noise field. And then once you do that, then you can show that you would get something like, I mean, it's actually, I'm not sure actually how I'm doing on time. I'm not doing very good, right? Okay. No, but yeah, I should have emphasized this. Starting from this, we get to this exactly.
So if I just do like static or equal time correlation functions, they're just going given by classical correlation functions.
Right.
But if I want to some sort of non-equal time, then you need to do all this model way.
This is, yeah. So if you want to do something which you care about non-equal time correlation functions, then we have to go to this Langevin equation. It becomes just this model A. So actually, not always is driven dissipative model. Not always they become model A, but they typically become some variation of. Not by I mean, we just know a few examples that you can work this out. But in some cases, we get something more exotic. But yeah. So in this case, okay. Okay, but this model is actually richer. We get a first order phase transition. So here I told you we get this thermal phase transition, which is a second order phase transition. But on this side, we get the first order phase transition. And the way we can see this is that in this phi 4 theory, the coefficient of phi to the fourth actually becomes negative as you approach this point. So in fact, you get the first order phase transition on this side. And there is a tricritical point here where the second order phase transition merges with the first order phase transition. So just to remember a few things, this model effectively behaves in a thermal way, but the effective temperature has a non-trivial dependence on the parameters of the problem. And the phase diagram in principle can be something quite rich. We have second and first order phase transition in the tricritical point. But in this model, the phases have not really, so the phases are basically the same. We get two distinct phases, but different phase transitions when we go beyond mean field. But in principle, we can also get completely different phases. And depending how much time I have, I would go through these slides or not. So I don't know, how much time?
How much time would
it
take you?
Do you have something else coming after this or not?
Yep. Okay, I have a few slides. Just continue? Okay. So let me go through this very briefly. So I told you that, so here we have same phases but different phase transition. But in principle, we can have, we can start with some other many-body Hamiltonian with some dissipation. And mean field sometimes tells you that you have a bias stable region. So you have a region that you have two different phases, which are both stable at the level of mean field. So it seems like you can have the coexistence of two phases even in the thermodynamic limit. Of course, sometimes also in equilibrium, we have a similar situation. But in equilibrium, we have the free energy, which would determine what is. So there could be two different phases. There could be two different phases which are locally stable. So we might be in this phase or in this phase in equilibrium. But we know that in equilibrium, the one which has the absolute minimum value of energy should be the actual ground state, or I don't know, at the finite temperature, the actual state of the system. So doing this Kalish approach, we can also do something similar here. Even though at this level we don't have any notion of free energy, we can map this to some description which has some effective free energy. And that would actually tell us that we get something very similar to the gas liquid phase transition. So here, in some generic point here, we just have one globally stable phase. While at the level of mean field, of course, you don't know what's going on. And OK, so this is a technical point. I told you that we can integrate out certain components. Sometimes we have to do something more complicated. We have to identify which directions in this field space is critical and which component is not critical. OK, this is another interesting feature of the systems, that the dissipation rate controls two different things. First of all, it controls the phase of the system, but also it controls the effective temperature. But usually these two are two different knobs, so we can control them separately. So if you look at some other many-body Hamiltonian with some generic dissipation, at the level of mean field, you get a phase diagram like this. So at the small values of dissipation, you get something like an XY phase. But for larger values of dissipation, you get a disordered phase. But if you actually do this more carefully, you can read off the effective temperature. So in fact, in this model, it turns out that the effective temperature is high enough so that it just completely destroys order. OK, this is. So in all the models that I talked about so far, we get some thermal equilibrium behavior. And this is because this, the dynamics of the system at low frequencies is overdamped. So omega is some factor of I multiplied by something. So that means that the system just behaves in a purely dissipative way. Could we get something beyond this, which is not mapped to thermal equilibrium? I told you about exciton polariton condensates. In these systems, we have a system which is underdamped. So we have a term like this, but we also have a real term. But it turns out that, at least in three dimensions, it turns out that the long wavelength behavior of the system is also purely the dissipative. So starting with something more complicated, in the long wavelengths, we will just get to the same behavior. But in two dimensions, something completely different happens. The condensate in two dimensions would be destroyed. And in fact, the equation that describes the system cannot be mapped to equilibrium. You would get a classical behavior, but in a fashion that is non-equilibrium. For those of you who noticed, it becomes the KPZ equation, which describes a non-equilibrium system in classical statistical mechanics. Another interesting question we can ask is that, OK, so we get this thermal behavior or classical behavior in this driven dissipative systems. But is it possible that we would get some analog of the quantum phase transition or quantum criticality? And the answer is we don't know, really. In fact, we can ask a more ambitious question. So in thinking about driven dissipative models, I told you that the effective behavior for a number of models just behaves in a classical and in an equilibrium fashion. There are examples that the system maps to something classical, which is nevertheless non-equilibrium. And I just ask whether we can get behavior similar to quantum phase transition. But even a more exciting question or direction would be, can we get something which is genuinely quantum, but it is also genuinely non-equilibrium? And this is very much an open question. OK, so this talk was really focused on this corner of the table, that we have this classical equilibrium behavior. But even in this corner of the table, it's not always obvious what would be the phases and the phase transition between them. And this is also relevant to many experiments. So even this corner often requires some work to show which phases survive and what is the phase transition between them. OK, so I get to the summary of my talk. I'm running over time, so let me just leave you with this slide. And thank you for your attention. Okay, so one thing is that to get the quantum phase transition exactly like the point that we identify as the quantum phase transition in this system, we're dealing with a pure state. So if we think about, if we insist that we want to get the pure state, I think there are some directions along which we can think. So under this driven dissipative dynamics, we can still get some pure states under certain conditions. But if we allow ourselves to be in this regime, in this quantum critical regime, that we don't have exactly a pure state, we have a mixed state, but the correlation and specifically the dynamics in this region is described by this quantum critical region, I think the answer should be yes.
But here, even in this particular state, your state in general involves in a mixed state.
That's true.
Because you have some quantum
correlation. Right, exactly. In principle, we can be in this regime. So far, we've looked at regimes like this. But whether we can come up with a driven dissipative model, which we can identify this quantum critical region, I think it doesn't have to be a pure state. So as you said, it can also be a mixed state somewhere here. But we haven't really identified a driven dissipative model in a quantum critical region. But in principle, I mean, it's been proved to be hard, but in principle, I don't see any reason why we shouldn't be able to get this.
So if you fine-tune the system to make quadratic quantum dense, is it for one possibility?
So yeah, that's actually the thing. So if we have a finite, if we have an infinitesimal amount of dissipation, then we just have this quadratic term, and we cannot really get rid of this. So if we add more noise, that term, which is proportional to the quadratic of the quantum field, we cannot make them interfere like with the minus sign. If we add any type of noise, we can only add to the coefficient of the quantum field squared. Is it okay? So for example, we can have a system which has a loss, let's say by some rate gamma loss, but also some pumping in the system. So this is the very definition of a driven dissipative problem. So in principle, we can tune the system where gamma L minus gamma P, the loss minus pump, is actually zero. So that defines some critical point. But the term that shows up in the coefficient of this quadratic term of the quantum field would be gamma L plus gamma pump. So any kind of noise that we add to the system, it just contributes additively to the coefficient of this term. So I don't think just by fine-tuning dissipation, we can set this to zero.
And I understand that exactly that same combination always appears in front of the linear time derivative term?
It can be more common, yeah, more or less. You know, sometimes actually the coefficient of this time derivative is just one. So this is sort of a description for this driven dissipative condensate. So in that case, the coefficient of the time derivative is just one. So we have dt phi, actually let me call it psi because it's complex conjugate. We have psi classical, psi quantum, and then we get various terms. We get another term, which is gamma L minus gamma P divided by 2 with a factor of I. And so on. And then we get this gamma L plus gamma p phi quantum squared. Sorry, this is, should be psi. Psi, and this is psi quantum squared. But here, what happens is actually, in some sense, is a little more exotic. Because we integrate out certain components, it gives rise to a time derivative for the critical components. And so in this driven dissipative Isa model that I described, also the coefficient of the time derivative picks up a factor of gamma. So, but what I'm saying is that fine-tuning the noise in the system can help with identifying a critical point, but it doesn't really help with killing this term, which is responsible for this emergent thermal behavior.
So this is probably a broad question. So in the beginning of your set, you want to bring the detail balance. So here, the way you did it is basically you introduce a driving term that brings the detail balance. Another way to do that is to say pass a thermal current or high temperature gradient. Right? So in that scenario,
sorry, I can handle
so
what?
Suppose you have temperature gradient or,
right,
you know, or a constant electric field, which also break,
right,
the detail balance. So there, do you expect that you still have this effective thermal behavior?
No. So in that case, if you just have a current in the system, you can get quantum criticality. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that would be. So that's where you have a coupling to BEV at boundaries of the system. So that would be completely different from this.
But
so
if the bulk of the system is also coupled to thermal BEV?
I mean, if the environment to begin with is thermal, then I wouldn't be surprised that the system also behaves in a thermal way, right?
But there's also a current there. So even if you map it to a constant system, it wouldn't
be right.
A constant system.
Right, exactly. So yeah, those systems would behave I mean, sometimes, in some cases, actually I shouldn't say this because I'm not completely sure, but I know that there are cases that you have a current in the system and you can get a quantum critical behavior. So yeah, that would be, I think that would be very different from the kind of model that I'm describing here.
Kinds of dissipation, you have an optical system, so it's like, you know, photons, right? Like such as some of these two-level systems, just, you know, just decays, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's related to the photon escaping the system.
Yes.
Right? But it's, you know, it also, it only escapes at the boundary, so.
Not really. At each site, you can have decay, right?
But it's.
Well, I guess you're saying that for a realistic experimental system, maybe you're good just by assuming that there is some loss happening only at the boundary of the system. Yeah. I guess it depends on the system.
Maybe it depends on whether you think of the photon as part of the system or not.
I can give you examples. For example, in these Rydberg systems, so each two-level system, I mean, has its own dynamics, but it also has its direct coupling to environment. So each two-level system independently decays into environment, right? But I guess you're imagining a kind of situation that we have, let's say, some boundaries, and this can be one-dimensional, two-dimensional, but losses, and I don't know, maybe there is a cavity here, and then you're thinking about the loss only happening at the boundaries.
Right. But it's really only gone once it escapes the system, right? So it depends on what you. Whether you think of the photon as part of your system, or whether you think of it as a.
So I don't consider the back action of the photon which is emitted on the system itself. Yeah, that would make it more complicated. So I'm assuming that the decay is happening independently at each site.
Let's thank Mohammed again.